Support is provided by the Lumina Foundation, with a goal to increase the percentage of Americans with high-quality degrees and credentials to 60% by the year 2025, focused on ensuring an accessible, responsive, and accountable higher education system. And by the team at Gelser Investment Management, focused on individuals and families, helping to build, manage, preserve, and transfer wealth for generations, commemorating 45 years in business. Gelser.
The opinions and commentary expressed in the following presentation do not reflect the views of this station, the Economic Club of Indiana, or the Economic Club's agents or sponsors. Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. Today we present James Haslam, CEO, Pilot Corporation, and majority owner of the Cleveland Browns.
I'm pleased to welcome you to the Economic Club of Indiana. I'm Deborah Daniels, a partner in the law firm of Krieg DeVault and president of the Economic Club this year. Our speaker today is a major figure in two important American enterprises. As chairman and CEO of the Pilot Corporation, a significant player in the transportation industry, and as majority owner of the Cleveland Browns in the National Football League. James Haslam III, close friends call him Jimmy, went to work for the family-owned Pilot Corporation after graduating from the University of Tennessee. When he started with the company, it had fewer than 100 gas stations and no truck stops. In the mid-1980s, Mr. Haslam saw a competitor's truck stop and came up with the idea of the truck stop business. Today, the Pilot Corporation operates a chain of convenience and travel centers across North America and is majority owner of Pilot Flying J, the largest truck stop business in the world. The company is also the largest supplier of fuel to the fracking and drilling industry. It has over $29 billion in annual sales. Pilot has come a long way under Jimmy Haslam's leadership since the company was founded by his father in 1958 with the purchase of a single gas station. And as if providing leadership for Pilot in a highly competitive industry weren't challenging enough, Mr. Haslam took on another significant management role in October 2012 with the purchase of the Cleveland Browns. He's taking bold steps, I think you'll agree, to return the Browns to their earlier glory days and put a new management team in place only a few weeks ago. Now he must figure out how to compete every year with the Baltimore Ravens, the Cincinnati Bengals, and the Pittsburgh Steelers, which he previously was part owner of, and maybe even the Indianapolis Colts. Please join me in welcoming this noteworthy figure who will talk to us about entrepreneurialism and the National Football League, Jimmy Haslam.
Great job. Thank you. Deborah, I got to tell you, there's been a lot of descriptions of the management moves we've made, and bold is the kindest one, so I appreciate that tremendously. Most of them are unprintable, if you want to know the truth, so I really appreciate that. Deborah and I have something in common in that her brother was governor, of course, of the great state of Indiana, and my brother is now governor of Tennessee, and I don't know how you found that, but it's given me, and this is my younger brother, so it's given me a great dose of humility. Several months ago, I came back from a long road trip, and I had food poisoning. I called our doctor, who's a cardiologist, and he said, well, meet me up at the emergency room. He checked me out. He said, I think you're okay, but I want to put you in cardiac care for the night just to make sure everything's okay. You'll get great care. Now, remember that, great care. So he took me up there, and he and my wife, and it was about 11. I said, you guys can go. And he says, you got your own nurse. He'll come in and take great care of you. And I said, great, great. I'm sure I'll be fine. The nurse comes in. It was a male nurse, and he sees the name Haslam, and he goes, are you the governor or the truck stop guy? Well, it gets better. And I said, well, I'm the truck stop guy. And he kind of goes, oh, and he never came back the whole night. So, yeah, Deborah said I should have said I was the governor, right? A similar thing, I was actually with my brother this weekend, and I was telling him this story, and he said, well, I've got one even better. He said his wife Chrissy and he, and I'm sure it was the same way in Indiana, when you're governor, you don't drive any, and you have troopers driving you around, and they were in a small town in rural Tennessee, and they went in this West Tennessee, and that's where his wife's from. They went in this little bitty store, and the guy running the store, or working in the store, had dated Bill's wife, Chrissy, some in high school. And it was this little dinky store, a little out of town. And they came out, and Bill's, you know, here he is, governor of Tennessee, sitting in the back of this big Lincoln with two troopers driving around. And Bill looked over with a smirk and said, "Well, what do you think you'd be doing if you were married to him, if you'd have married him?" And she quickly came back, "I'd be the wife of the governor of Tennessee." So I was glad to see that even as governor, and I know our brothers share a lot in common, and I was telling Deborah, my brother Bill, actually, before he ran, during his race, and after he was elected, spent a lot of time up here. Mitch was very gracious to give him time, and they're both very humble, self-deprecating people, and I think we would all agree that, candidly, we need a lot more people like that in public office. So thanks for the very kind remarks. I would be doing a terrible disservice if I didn't recognize one of our very best customers out here, Steve and John Russell, who, of course, control the Celadon Corp, based here in Indianapolis. Great friends and great customers. So thank you all for coming. And more importantly, thanks for the business. We appreciate it. I'm always a little hesitant to get up before a group like this and act like, you know, you're an expert on business. You know a lot about business because there's a lot of really good people out here. And I'll tell you, for every good move we've made, we've made about five or six bad ones, and I mean that sincerely. But I'll try to share a little bit about growing a private business, which is what we have, that's family-owned. And then if you're like most people, you'd a lot rather hear about the NFL. Steve, you'll appreciate this. I was up in Detroit last week and called on a guy, had 350, 400 trucks, and we had a good visit with the president and the CFO and talked about trucking and the diesel business and transportation for about 45 minutes. Of course, up there, everything's about the car business. And yeah, I'm real sensitive to not taking too much of people's time. And I said, "Well, it's time for us to go." And he goes, "Whoa, whoa, 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 whoa." And I thought, oh, man, he wants a better deal. He's like Steve, he wants a better deal. And I said, "Yes, sir, what's up?" And he goes, "Tell me about the draft." And then we talked another 45 minutes about pro football. But let me just talk a little bit about business. My dad started the business in 1958 with one gas station. And there's five or six things that I think have been consistent with us, and if we've achieved any success, it's because of that. And the first is the ability to change. And I'll go through two examples of how we've changed. The first way we've changed is we started out in the gas station business, and looking around, most of you are probably too young to remember when there were just stations that sold gas and people pumped gas in your car, et cetera. That changed in the 70s, and we got in the convenience store business. And in the 80s, we got in the kind of the small pumper truck stop business. And in the 90s and 2000s, we got in the larger truck stop business. And we changed because we had to change. When we first were in the gasoline business, you could make a living just selling gasoline. Then it got too competitive. You had to have C stores. Then we felt like there was an opportunity in the truck stop business. So it's a company that's continually changed. We've not only changed the businesses we're in, but we've also changed our capital structure. Being a privately owned business in a very capital intensive business that needs a lot of money like ours have, we've always had partners. And so my dad started the business in 58. He owned it himself till 64. He thought, you know, I'm never going to grow this thing if I don't have a partner. So he partnered with Marathon Oil out of Findlay, Ohio. They were partners from 64 to 88. We split because they didn't want to get in the truck stop business, and we wanted to build a nationwide chain of truck stops. This is an amicable split, and they were our best supplier after that. In 2001, we looked around, and our industry was very crowded. Remember, we're a privately owned business, capital intensive. And we thought, you know, there's going to be tremendous consolidation, and we can either be a consolidator, if you will, or a consolidatee. And we thought we'd a lot rather be the OR. And so we looked around, and we hired an investment banker, Morgan Stanley, and they went out and searched for a partner, and they came back with, "We think this is the perfect partner for you." And lo and behold, it was Marathon Oil again. Completely different set of managers. Guys were now my age as opposed to my dad's age, but we're partners with them from 01 to 07. In 07, their management in Houston looked around and said, "Why do we own half of a truck stop chain? Doesn't make sense. You need to sell it." At the time, as a family, we thought, well, do we buy it back all ourselves, or do we take on a partner? And we have always been very fortunate, and if you have a privately owned business, I would suggest you do it. We've always had an outside board. Now, they have no real governance, but they're all really smart people who have run or run businesses who have given us great advice. And one of our directors said, "You know, I have this friend in New York who's just gone to work for a private equity firm. Let's have him down and just pick his brain for the day." We had him down, picked his brain. That firm is called CVC Equity, CVC Capital Partners. They're based in Europe, but it's as big as Blackstone or some of the other big investment or private equity groups you've had here. So we partnered with them in 2008. And at the time, you know, is this going to work out or not? Some people don't like private equity. Well, we were really lucky in that in 2009, our largest competitor, Flying J, declared bankruptcy. And unfortunate for them, but fortunate for us. And this is a company we had pursued for 10 years to try to put the two entities together. They declared bankruptcy, you know, in May. In June, they called us and said, all right, we'll consider partnering, but we've got to have $150 million in financing by Monday. And this was on Friday. And we could have never at Pilot had the, one, had the capital, and two, had the expertise to put that together. And so CBC helped us accomplish that. We put the two companies together, and it's been, we've been fortunate to make some good moves in business, but it's been by far the best move. CBC is now phasing out, and so Pilot and Flying J, the two original families, are going to increase their ownership. But I think key takeaway in today's world, and things are changing so quickly, is you've got to be ready to change, because if you don't change, you could be left at the starting line and never get in the game or be thrown out of the game. So change is extremely important. The second thing I would say is, and this probably sounds overly simple, but I talk to a lot of young guys who have this idea or that idea on business, and make sure the concept or the business model works. And I know you think, well, guy, of course, but just make sure it works. Here's the second part that's really important, okay? Make sure that technology is not going to take you out of business in the next 2 or 3 years or the next 5 years. One of my best friends in Knoxville comes from a very prominent business family in the Southeast, been extremely successful in multiple businesses, taking a lot of them public. And they had a business that sold all the music to Walmart, okay? That doesn't sound like it'd be good. It was unbelievable. Cash flow every year of nine figures. I mean, hugely profitable business. Now they have Walmart, Target, and Best Buy, and their profits are 25% of what they were because of downloading. And I've sat there and watched that, and the family's fine. They have multiple businesses. But I've sat there and watched that happen, and it's had a profound impact on me to always be looking out and saying, okay, what could happen to us? And, of course, with us, the threat is, okay, are there electric cars? Are there electric trucks? Steve, I don't think anybody thinks there's going to be electric trucks anytime soon. Electric cars seem to have gone by the wayside. But what has happened is all the new cars get much better mileage. We're selling 16 million cars a year. Average new car gets 34 miles a gallon. It's replacing a car that got 22 miles a gallon. Steve and John can talk a lot about more about mileage than I can, but the new trucks are getting probably 12-15% better mileage than the old trucks. So our threat is not that the business is going to go away overnight like my friend's music business did, but that the pie is going to gradually shrink. And when you have the largest share of that pie, it's an obvious threat. So make sure your business model works and make sure technology is not going to take you out of business. The third thing I would say is make sure you got really good people. And our company has gone through a very difficult time period since last April, and that we're the subject of a federal investigation in dealing with did our salespeople treat customers unfairly. And it appears as if some of our salespeople did make bad decisions. And I actually fought myself with this, okay? And the reason I fought myself is between 2009 and 2013, we doubled the size of our company, okay? And that all sounds great, but you've got to make sure that you also double the size of your talent. And in legal and internal audit, in several key areas, systems and controls, we did not do that, and it came back to bite us big time. Now, the company's going to survive. We're going to be fine, but it's a tremendous embarrassment to the company and the family, and it's candidly, it's been a very expensive learning lesson. So the third thing I would say is make sure you have really good people. I'm going to talk about the NFL in a little bit, but that's – if you ask me what I learned from the NFL is it's all about people, okay, whether it be players, coaches, general managers. But make sure you have really good people. Fourth thing I would say, and this might sound really elementary too, but you got to work hard. You really do. You got to work hard. I don't know of anybody who's successful and whether they run. I met the gentleman who ran Goodwill up here in Indianapolis, now over $100 million business, which is phenomenal. I guarantee you he works hard. And whether you're the pastor of a church, a coach of a high school basketball team, you run a business, you've got to work hard and you've got to put the time in. And what really helps is if you like the business. My dad says all the time, Pilot is our vocation, but it's also our avocation. In other words, it's our job and it's also our hobby. Steve Russell says you're lucky in the morning if you get up and you like going to work, and then you also like coming home to work because that means you like your spouse. And I think that's well said. So you got to work hard, and it's obviously extremely helpful if you like your job. The fifth thing is, and I think this is really important, is you got to set goals and you got to hold people accountable. Okay? You got to set goals and you got to hold people accountable. And that's one of the things that I think business does best is, I was talking to, I won't name him, but an individual who was now in the academic field, in the education business, and I said, what's the biggest difference? He said, well, they don't really like accountability, and that's probably too broad-based and unfair. It might be unfair to some people in the room, but in business, I think we do a really good job of holding people accountable, of setting out, here's your 10 goals, here's your 5 goals, whatever it might be, and then following up to make sure that happens. It's amazing to me how many smaller companies I walk into that don't have clear set goals. I promise you at Celadon, they have a very clear set of goals for the company and for each of the individuals, key individuals involved there. And then the last thing, and you'll probably laugh at this, you got to be a little bit lucky, okay? You got to be a little bit lucky. When Deborah talked about us, the first person that introduced us to a truck stop, this truck stop was down in Slidell, Louisiana. How many people know where that is? There you go. More than I would have thought. It's right outside of New Orleans. I hope nobody's from there. It's not much of a town, okay? I remember we flew in on a little bitty airplane to time, barely got in. My dad looked at me and said, this damn well better be worth it. And, of course, fortunately it was. But the individual who owned this truck stop, we're from Knoxville, graduated from Tennessee like my dad and I, and he also played football like my dad did. And so he took an instant liking to us, and he shared everything with us. And I know we wouldn't have the truck stop chain we have today if he hadn't have taken the time to show us everything, because we knew nothing. So those are just a few insights I hope are helpful. Whenever I hear somebody talk, I always think, well, if I can take away one or two things, it's a win, and hopefully you can. Let me shift gears now to everybody's favorite subject, the NFL. Before I do that, though, I was telling Al, I was up here for the combine, and growing up, I was not an Indianapolis Colts fan, but when your former quarterback who played at Tennessee came up there and who's a great friend, you don't know how many fans of the Indianapolis Colts there are and were in Knoxville, Tennessee. And so we came up here a lot to games, came to the Super Bowl, came to the combine, and Indianapolis, and I mean this, my brother was mayor before he was governor, is a town that works. I mean, y'all get stuff done. It's easy to find your way around. But most importantly and most impressively, the people up here are phenomenal. I was staying at the Conrad Hilton, and to find your way over to where the combine is, you know, and navigate through the convention center, and I was going through the PNC Bank building, everybody went out of their way to help and make things convenient. And I found the same thing every time I'm up here. I know you all have a big bid in for the Super Bowl in 18, and believe me, that stuff does go noticed. So really nice place to do business, really nice place to visit. In terms of NFL, let me say two or three things, and most of these are obvious too, and you'll laugh at the first thing. It's a big deal, okay? I used to be able to go anywhere, say anything, and nobody noticed or nobody cared, and we run a pretty good big business, and my brother's governor of Tennessee, but the NFL is a big deal. I was in Detroit, like I said, last week calling on trucking companies, and our controller had sent me some financial models about 10 o'clock, and I went downstairs to get them. And I'm getting off the elevator, and a guy looks at me and he goes, you're George Haslam. And I went, well, close, I'm Jimmy Haslam. But everywhere you go, people recognize you. And NFL is a big deal. Some of you may know this. Of the top 25 TV shows, so I think it's top 30 TV shows this fall, 29 of them were NFL games, okay? It's just a big deal in the country, and everybody follows it. The second comment I would make is, and I'll tell you one other story about Cleveland. Cleveland is a huge football town. I mean, football started in northeastern Ohio. The Browns, for how is unsuccessful, have been on the field, still have an unbelievable following. I've been up there about a week, and I always just travel around by myself, no entourage or anything. And I walked in a downtown businessman to see one of the civic leaders of Cleveland, and I walked up to a security guy because I was a little confused where I was. And before, the guy is about 70 years old and probably about, 5'3". And I'm walking up to him. I'm dressed like this. He could have no idea who I am, right? And I'm getting ready to go up and ask directions to this gentleman's office. I get within about 10 feet of him. He goes, Jimmy, when are we going to start winning? So I was like, man, I just got here. We hadn't even closed on the team yet, I'd say this, though, about the NFL. And I mentioned this in our comments on business. It is more about people than anything I've ever been associated with. And we have 22,000 people that work with us at Pilot Flying J, very people-intensive business. If you think about it, we don't have any assets, and I'm pretty sure the Colts are the same way. We don't own our stadium. The city does. We don't own our practice facility. Another city owns it. And I think the Colts are the same way. Y'all correct me if I'm wrong. And so our assets are our people. And so getting the right people in the right place, and whether that's general manager, coach, somebody run the business side, and then obviously getting the right players. And I'll give Mr. Irsay, I don't know that anybody's ever had a run where your quarterbacks are Manning and Luck. And so I whether it was luck or skill, I remember my point number six, I give him a lot of credit for having two great quarterbacks who are also great people. But having the right people in the NFL, that has impacted, one, I've learned the hard way that you got to do it, and two, it's actually impacted how I look at business. But people are really important. Really, really important. The last thing I would say is, and I've said this publicly, is it's been a learning curve to be an NFL owner. I'd been around football all my life, and as Deborah mentioned, been a minority owner of the Steelers. But to be the controlling owner of an NFL team, there's not a book or a manual they give you that gets you prepared. And so you learn on the job, and some of us have learned on the job, except this is just so public. And so whenever you make a change, everybody in the world knows. And it's been, I was telling Al Hubbard this on the way out from the airport, it's very intellectually challenging. And I never would have thought that, but getting the right people to work with you. We're going through free agency right now, as I know Indianapolis is. By the way, the middle linebacker you said that used to play for us, DeQuell Jackson, is one of the best people I've ever met. He doesn't fit our new style of defense, the way our guys play, but and he'll fit here, but he's a great person. I mean, a great person, and you'll like having part of your community, and he'll be a solid citizen. But just learning the business has been a real challenge. It's been really interesting. As I said, we're going through free agency right now, and we literally get in a room for 5 or 6 hours and debate, okay, safeties, cornerbacks, quarterbacks, and you're talking about, you know, what kind of production they have, how old they are, whether you can sign them or not, what kind of people they are, et cetera. And so it's been a really interesting, we obviously feel very fortunate to have an NFL franchise, particularly an iconic one like the Browns, but it's been a great learning experience. I'm not saying I know a lot now, but I know a lot more than I did a year ago. So I hope that's of help and some interest, and would be glad to answer any questions that might be pertinent now.
Jimmy. And so, as a reminder, please use the white cards on your table if you have a question for Mr. Haslam, or tweet us at Economic Club IN. So let's start with this. You talked about the things that I'm not going there yet. you talked about the things that you think are important to any business to make it successful, but you've become a really dominant player in your industry in a fairly short time. To what do you attribute that? What differentiates you from your competitors?
Good question. And I would not at all suggest that we're dominant. We have the leading market share, but it's a very competitive business that is driven a lot by price. Diesel fuel is diesel fuel, and you can't distinguish one person's diesel fuel as being better than the other. So it's very competitive. I would say the things we talk about, we have had really good people. We have really good real estate, and we work hard, and conceptually our business model works.
When you hire, and you talked about needing good people, and someone asks, when you hire top managers into your organization, what are the leading three qualities that you look for?
Well, let's assume it's a given that they're going to have good character and good ethic, good work, and, you know, good basic background. I think hard work is certainly one. I think smarts is two. I'd actually put smarts one. It was interesting when we went through the NFL interviewing process, the really successful coaches, and we've had the opportunity to spend time with the Belichicks and the Parcells of the world, they're really smart guys. They'd be really good at anything. So I'd say smart, strong work ethic, and collaborative in their style. Some of these coaches are easy to work with, and some are difficult to work with. And the coach, and I'm not sure exactly how they work in Indianapolis now, but the coach and general manager have to work really closely together, and I think it's the same way in business. So I'd say smart, strong work ethic, and collaborative in terms of how they conduct themselves.
You know, not surprisingly, we're getting a lot of football questions. And since someone went to the trouble to prepare these before he even came, let me ask this. Loyal Browns fans have been longing for a winning product on the playing field. What high-level strategies are you incorporating that you can share to reboot the franchise?
Well, let me say, and I spoke to some Browns fans earlier who are sitting down here. First of all, thanks for your support. The support we have is better than we deserve, and we hope to turn that around. It's no different what we just talked about. It's all about having good coaches and then having good players. I mean, when the NFL, when you're in the approval process of being an owner, they send you around to talk to 10 or 12 of the owners who generally happen to be, you know, very successful owners. And I would always ask, well, what's the key to success? And they said, get a good quarterback and get a good coach. And, you know, that's oversimplified, but, you know, that's what you got to do. And I think we've hired a real good coach in Mike Pettine, who's been a defensive coordinator, first time being a head coach, smart guy, UVA graduate. And hopefully we can get the players on the field to match his talent. And if we can, we'll be a lot better. The NFL is socialistic. It's owned by a bunch of capitalists, but it's socialistic. And if you don't win, it's your fault. I mean, because it's a level playing field. Green Bay is a town of, 165,000, and they've won several world championships, Super Bowls. So it's all about having the right people.
And having said that, someone asks, how does the football business really differ from the truck stop business?
Well, I think I said earlier, it is so much more high profile that there is absolutely no comparison, just because everything about the NFL is so visible. And of course, the world we live in today, there's probably tweets and emails and things going off right now because all these free agent signings are going to be announced. There's no secrets that everything's out there. It's just the high profile is what it took me a while to get used to. And you got to be really careful about what you say. We had brought a president in from the outside to allow me to spend a little bit more time at a strategic level with our business and to concentrate on the Browns. And great guy, very talented, just not a good fit. And in the press conference, we announced that he was going to step aside and I was going to come back. I said, I'm returning to my first love. Well, I just thought that was natural because it's a business I grew up in. Well, in Cleveland, I got massacred for that, right? Because my first love is supposed to be what? The Browns, right? So you got to be careful what you say.
Well, then I guess it's time to ask you, what are the odds that Darrell Revis will play for the Browns this year?
Do you know who Darrell Revis is?
Oh, heck no.
No, he's a really good player. I'm not sure where he'll end up, but he's a really good player, and I understand a really good person. So he may end up here. I don't know.
Well, and someone else asks, can the Colts have a mulligan on the Richards trade?
You got to give that a little time. He's a good player. He's a good guy, and we'll see how it works out over a period of time. So I found myself rooting against the Colts after we made that trade because, unfortunately, you all ended up having a really good year, and what we were hoping was going to be at the 15th pick ended up being the 26th pick. So every game you won, including that one over Kansas City, I think we would have had the 21st or 22nd pick, you know, was a killer, but really good year by the Colts. And you're going to be really good for a long time because you got that guy named Luck, and he's tremendous player.
Should the extra point be moved to the 25-yard line?
You know, I'm a little more of a traditionalist. I don't see any need to change that myself. So,
a little more into the industry aspect, to what degree do you consider the in-home viewing experience to be competition for the in-stadium experience?
I think we did a lot of due diligence when we investigated buying an NFL team. And the biggest threat at the time was the whole concussion litigation, everything surrounding that. And it appears that the NFL and the Players Union have reached an agreement on that, although Judge Brody has not given it final approval, and there may be some details to work out. Assuming that's aside, then in-game attendance is the biggest worry we have. And we all know why, because the experience at home now, watching on, you know, your massive big screen or big screens, as opposed to an hour drive to the game, a 3 or 4 hour game experience, an hour drive home. You know, it's particularly, you all play inside here, but imagine what it's like in Cleveland on December 15th. And, you know, people say, you know, I think I'll stay home, sit on the couch and watch multiple games. And I'll watch the Browns. So it is our biggest challenge, making sure we keep people in the seats in the stadium. And what we're all trying to do, and the NFL is coordinating this, is give you something when you come to the game that you can't get at home on TV. And there's, of course, the sport that does the best at that is NASCAR, right? If you're a NASCAR fan, they do a tremendous job because you literally can hear Dale Earnhardt's crew chief talking to Dale Earnhardt as he goes around the track. And does that ever happen in football? I don't know. It probably has a better chance of happening than we think if you can protect the privacy. I mean, I think everybody in here would like to hear the play called into Andrew Luck, right? I mean, and so would that make it worth coming to the game? Maybe. So we got to be really creative in getting people to come to the games.
Well, this person also asked, is the blackout rule outdated?
You know, I don't know enough to comment on that. So fortunately, we've been able to dodge that. And you all do here. You got great fans.
Well, in that case, I have a couple of questions from a Browns fan, one of which is about the uniform. But let me ask this. Any plans to redevelop the area around Browns Stadium? Indy would be a good place to look for ideas.
Well, you all done a great job here because you put the stadium right downtown. If you're familiar with Cleveland, it sounds good, but we're on the lake, and the lake is separated from downtown by I-90 and by the railroad tracks, so it's not nearly as convenient or conducive. I mean, I stayed at the Conrad Hilton, it's a 5-minute walk, and you're in Lucas Stadium, so it's not nearly as convenient as what you have. That development is planned, but we don't own anything. We lease a stadium from the city, and it'll be up to the city and other people, up their private developers, to determine if that makes sense. But I love where your stadium is here, right downtown, right in the middle of everything. Some point in time, we'll need to build a new stadium in Cleveland, and hopefully we'll have that type of opportunity like you do here. And I got to believe it's great for downtown, too.
If a minority group would like to own a franchise, what advice would you give to that group?
They want to own a minority part of a franchise?
If a minority group wants to own a franchise in professional sports or otherwise.
Well, if we're talking about a group of minorities, it's no different than anything else. I talked about Luck earlier. I didn't talk about how we got involved in the Steelers. I mentioned that pilots always been a very capital-intensive business, and so we always had banks coming to Knoxville to call on us because we always needed money, candidly. And went to dinner with a group of bankers from New York, and they were leaving. And there was a young guy at the end of the table who hadn't said much, and I went up and introduced myself, and his name was Randy. I said, Randy, what are you doing? He said, well, I just happened to be with these guys today. My specialty is pro sports. And so I gave him a card, and I said, if anything ever comes up, call me. You know how that you do that all the time, right? And literally 10 years later, he calls and says, are you familiar with the Steelers situation? I said, no, not really. Why? And he said, well, the NFL's forcing them to sell, and they need to sell about 30-40% of the team, and would you be interested in owning 8-10% of the Steelers? And I said, you know, we're really not minority kind of guys, so thanks for calling, but we'll pass. Well, he, like a good banker, he's persistent, and he called me back about 2 weeks later and says, do you ever go to Pittsburgh? I said, yeah, I'm going next week. Why? We're going to look at a truck stop. And he says, well, why don't you go by and have lunch with Dan and Art Rooney? Well, like a lot of you out there, I'm a sports fan. I thought, well, that'd probably be interesting to do. Had no intention of investing. And so talk about setting you up. So they train at and they share a facility with the University of Pittsburgh. University of Pittsburgh is on the first floor. They're on the second floor. It's across the river from downtown Pittsburgh. And so I drive in there and park. I'm not really sure where I'm going. They tell me to go up the second floor. And the elevator opens up, and there's a trophy case with 5 Super Bowl trophies. And I don't care whether you're a man, woman, child, adult, whatever. That gets your attention. And, of course, now they have 6. And I thought, man, that's pretty cool. And I spent about 2 or 3 hours talking with Art and Dan Rooney. And what I figured out is they have a family business just like we do and probably a lot of you do. It's not nearly as lucrative of what we do, but much higher profile. And I also found them to be great family people and great people. And so I got back and I told my dad and brother about it. My dad goes, you don't want to do that. You're not going to have control. I said, well, they want me to come to New York and meet the commissioner. Why don't you come with me? And they're going to meet us up there too. And the whole time up, you know how your dad can get on. He's just dogging me. Why are you doing this? And he about had me convinced it was a bad idea. So we get to NFL office. And of course, he and Dan Rooney, the former ambassador to Ireland, are the same age. They're both 82 or 83 years old, and they hit it off. They knew everybody and et cetera. And by the time we're flying back, it was, well, when are we and we and we? And I said, well, are we going to write a check? And the answer was no. But it's like I said, a lot of luck involved in life. But you got to pursue it just like anything else. I got off the subject, Deborah. You got to pursue it like anything else. And we made it clear to the Rooneys and to the NFL that if the time ever came and we could afford it, one, and the opportunity was there, we'd take a look at a franchise. And so two or three times a year when I was up there on business, I would go by and spend time with whether it be Goodell or some of his lieutenants there at the NFL so that we had a working knowledge so that when something did come available like the Browns, you'd have a shot at it.
Did you really try to hire Jim Harbaugh?
Ooh. That's a really good franchise, and he's a really good coach.
Good answer. Great answer. Returning to your other major business.
Was that your question, Deborah?
No, it wasn't. I think it was Al's. Could you comment on how the commercial transportation industry was affected by the recession that began in 2008? Were there profitability losses?
Yeah, big time, just like most businesses. And here again, there's people, the Russells know a lot more about the movement of freight in the country than I do, but it's pretty well tied to the economy. And so you had that gangbuster time in the mid-2000s when the economy's growing mid-single digits and freight was growing that much, if not more. And when the recession hit in late 07, 08, you know, and all of a sudden freight growing at 3-4%, it was down 3-4%. There's a direct correlation between freight movement and gallons sold. So our business was no different than anybody else's in that it faced its challenges during those times. Like most businesses, we learned to control expenses and get by with selling a little bit more and controlling expenses a little bit better. But it had a definite impact. And I'll say this, the trucking industry gets a, quote, bad name. But most of the stuff that we eat, drink, sleep on, wear, et cetera, is delivered by trucks. And the men and women that drive those trucks are unsung heroes that are away from their family all the time, have a really tough job. Average driver's out 10 or 12 hours a day, is probably making $45,000 or $50,000 and paying their own expenses. It's a tough job. And so we go out of our way at Pilot Flying J to be nice to those people, because if not, you know, we wouldn't have the food on the table that we're having today. They do a great job, and it's a tough job.
And speaking of the trucking industry, trains are really the other
We don't really like trains.
Well, that was the question here. Can you compare how the two are faring these days, trucks and trains, and does one have a significant
advantage?
Yeah,
what has
advantage?
Happened is the business in the U.S., and here again it goes back to the 08, really ought to be commended for how much more efficient they are. And the problem we have is one person's efficiency is the other person's sales problem. And Lee Scott, who used to run Walmart, is on our board, and and I won't have the numbers right, but just think of a roll of toilet paper, okay? And what they used to be able to pack in three trucks, they can now pack in one truck. Well, that's great for Walmart. Candidly, it's great for the consumer, right, because they're going to get the product cheaper. But if you're in the trucking business, like Celadon, or you're in the business that sells fuel to trucking companies, it's not good. And so the efficiencies these companies have brought on have brought challenges to all of us. Freight that is not time sensitive now, particularly freight that comes into the West Coast, is put on rail. A lot of it goes to Chicago and then is dispersed off and put into trucks. So rail is a competition for us. Intermodal compiles about 6 or 7% of things that are shipped in the United States. So it pales in size the trucking industry. It will continue to grow though, because it's efficient in terms of cost, and if things aren't time sensitive, it's a pretty good way to ship things. What is being hauled a lot by rail now is, of course, and you've seen a lot of it in the news in a negative way, is all the crude oil that's being produced in the Bakken and other places is being hauled to these refineries, and rail is doing just hauling a tremendous amount of crude oil, and that'll continue to grow.
Many Americans are now resorting to shorter trips in their own cars for vacation travel. How has that affected the travel centers that you operate around the country?
You know, it's hard for us to gauge that. The big impact, and I covered it earlier, is just the improved MPG that the cars are getting. I think there's 150 million cars in the U.S. So if you sell 16 million a year, let's just call it 15, you're replacing 10% of the fleet. And if it gets 30% better mileage, you know, I'm not a rocket scientist at math, but that's 3% less consumption. So it's a real challenge for us. Here again, it's great for the company and country and great for the consumer. We just have to figure out a way to manage around it.
Now, this isn't exactly a question, and I promise it did not come from me, but it says here, no one ever says, hire more lawyers. Thanks for recognizing their value in high growth times at a company. I don't know if there's a question in there, but on behalf of my fellow lawyer out there, I guess, thank you. What was the most influential part of your upbringing that led you to be so driven and willing to take risks?
You know, like a lot of people in this room, great mom and great dad. My mom died at 22 of a ruptured aorta, which is obviously a huge shock. My dad, and I'm sure there's a lot of people in this room who are the same way, was not only my dad, but my best friend, and still is at 83. And so just having the opportunity to watch him work, build a business, former athlete. I had my 60th birthday this past weekend, and I invited my brother, my sister, my dad, and their spouses. So it just shows you how important family is, and it just felt like the right thing to do. And what was really great is my dad probably had the best time of anybody. So I think watching him and emulating him, we're a lot alike, but we're a lot different, you know, was great.
And speaking of your family and your brother and his job as governor of Tennessee, which do you think is the harder job, yours or his?
Probably running the Browns is probably the highest, because it's hardest because it's so high profile. You know, running a state, and you know this because you watched your brother do it and do a great job for 8 years, is not easy. On the other hand, Bill is blessed to have a very strong majority in his party, the Republican Party, in both the House and the Senate. And so he's been able to make some pretty dramatic changes, candidly copying a lot of things that Mitch did up here in terms of education and just being more efficient. So he will tell you, and I never asked this Mitch this, Deborah. I asked my brother all the time, how do you like it? You know, 1 to 10, and he said about a 9. You know, and I don't think any of us are much higher than that. And the reason he likes it is, and I have another great friend of Alan Cathy's too, that's a U.S. Senator, who likes his job less, because as mayor or governor, you can make a difference. And you can see progress being made. You can see education's changing and improving. He's doing the same charter school that things that you all have done up here, and you can see progress being made, government become more efficient. So he likes his job tremendously. You know, it's frustrating at times because it's in the public arena, and as he says, it moves a lot slower than you'd like things to move. But I think he has great job satisfaction. And we need more people from the private sector. My brother worked for us, then worked for Saks Fifth Avenue most of his career before he went into politics. And I just think we need people who've had jobs, who've controlled expenses, who've met a payroll, all the stuff that most of us do, run for office. We'd have a much better country. And my brother and Mitch the same way, they were not caught up in, their whole life wasn't being governor. So if he's not governor tomorrow, and Mitch has obviously been a great example of this, he still has his own identity and self-worth and who he is as a person. And unfortunately, we have a lot of people in Washington around these state houses that are a little bit different. I probably ought to be quiet on some of that stuff. My brother's up for election this year. I got to remember that.
And he loves that job. Well, let me ask you this in closing. What has been really the biggest challenge you've faced in building Pilot?
Well, I would say two things. One, and there's, I assume, a lot of people out here that run businesses, and I'll tell it, when I was in my 30s, I was on the board of directors of a publicly held company in Knoxville, and there was a gentleman who had run a really big Fortune 500 company who was also on the board, and I looked up to him a lot. And when my dad named me CEO, I really didn't think it was going to be that big a difference, because I'd been COO for a long time. And this gentleman came up to me at one of these board meetings, and he said, congratulations. And I said, well, thanks. I said, it's not really going to be that different. And he said, oh, yeah, it's going to be a lot different. It's a lot different when you're the guy at the top. And so just running and growing a large business, in the energy and the work ethic, and, you know, you have to be, when I go in these stops, I can't be down when I go in one of these stops or not fired up to visit our people. And so staying fired up, keeping everybody motivated, keeping all the balls in the air has been a huge challenge. And then this government investigation we're going through has been a challenge, but it's not fun, okay? Building a business is fun. So those would be by far the two biggest challenges we've had.
Please join me in
thanks a lot,
Mr. Hadley.
Great job.
Thanks so much, Jimmy, for taking the time to speak with us today. Please join us next month on Tuesday, April 22nd, as we're joined by Gail McGovern, President and CEO of the American Red Cross. Don't miss the opportunity to hear from one of the top 50 most powerful women in corporate America, who now leads one of the largest nonprofit relief organizations known throughout the world. More information and tickets may be obtained at economicclubofindiana.com. And we look forward to seeing you in April.
WFYI's Sam Clement follows up with James Haslam in this short discussion on Pilot Flying J's business model in the current and future economic climate.
Sam Clement with WFYI, sitting here with Cleveland Browns owner and president and CEO of Pilot Flying J, Jimmy Haslam. Mr. Haslam, thank you very much for joining me.
Sure.
You talked about the business model that works for Pilot Flying J. What is it about your model that has made you guys so successful?
Yeah, good question. I would say this. I ask people all the time, I'll ask you, are you in a bigger hurry than your parents? And I've never heard anybody say no, and we could argue whether that's good or bad. But people today need to multitask, and so whether it's a truck driver driving up and down I-70 who's going to stop and fuel and shower and have dinner with us, it's a mom taking her kids to school who wants to drive by Wendy's and get something to eat, a business person, you can multitask, accomplish several different things at our properties because they're large, they're easy to get in and out of, and they offer multiple products.
You mentioned with the mileage increasing with cars and the advances in technology there. What adjustments are you making? What innovative ideas are you having to stay sustainable in the long term?
Well, gasoline in the United States, I believe, will decline on a like-like basis in terms of total consumption by 1% or 2% for the indefinite future. And so what we've learned to do is be less dependent on gas and sell more things inside our stores, more food, more retail items, more restaurant items to take the pressure off gasoline.
What's been your key to success, being able to stay ahead of other convenience stores and truck stops?
Well, let me say there's a lot of great competitors out there in the business. I mean, Speedway, which is based in Ohio, has a huge presence here in Indianapolis. So there's a lot of great competitors. I think we've had really good people. That's where it starts. I think we have really good locations, and I think we're disciplined enough to try to do things on a daily basis fairly consistently.
You talked about multitasking in the business world. What's the challenge for you multitasking between Pilot Flying J and the Cleveland Browns?
You know, allocation of time. There's a lot to be done at both organizations. Pilot Flying J is, you know, we have 500 truck stops spread throughout the country. We're open 365 days a year, so there's always something going on. And Cleveland Browns, of course, have not been very good for a while, so it's a massive turnaround project, and that takes time, too. So it's allocating time on a daily and weekly basis.
You talked about Indianapolis and the success that they've had with their football franchise building the city. They're bidding for the 2018 Super Bowl. What do you think are their chances, and what do they offer that Minneapolis and New Orleans may not?
You know, I can't comment on their chances, but I'll say this. They did a great job with the last Super Bowl. I mentioned in my remarks I was up here for the Combine 2 or 3 weeks ago. It's a city that works. It's easy to get stuff done in. The people, as you know, are very friendly and very hospitable, so I wouldn't speculate on the chances. I think probably the best thing they have going for them is they did such a nice job last time.
And is the Combine playing to that as well? They've been such a good host. The city's been such a good host. Yeah. Do the owners look at that?
I would, but I can't speak for the other owners. I mean, my experience up here when I was here Friday night to Sunday night, in terms of, here again, just ease of getting things done, Indianapolis does a nice job.
When you come to an event like this and you share your story, what do you hope that other business owners, what business people take away from it?
You know, first of all, I don't want to be presumptuous that they would take away anything. As a younger person growing up, I had a lot of people who were older than I was give me great advice, and you hope that there's some younger people in here. If they can take away one or two things, it's a home run. And hopefully at least a few of them did that.
By speaking here, what do you take out of it, these types of experiences?
You know, I think you learn from every experience. I have known Governor Daniels at a distance, not real well, for several years, and it was really enjoyable to sit with his sister Deborah and hear a little bit more insight on Mitch and to learn about their family and their upbringing. And, you know, I learned more about Indianapolis. You meet a lot of smart, capable people here. And, of course, Al and Kathy Hubbard are amongst our best friends, so I could spend a little time with them, too.
You've been listening to James Haslam, CEO Pilot Corporation and majority owner of the Cleveland Browns. It's part of the 2013-2014 Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series. Next month at this time, join us for a speech from Gail J. McGovern, President and CEO of the American Red Cross. The Economic Club of Indiana is a production of WFYI Public Radio in Indianapolis for Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations. Thank you for joining us. I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
Support is provided by the Lumina Foundation, with a goal to increase the percentage of Americans with high-quality degrees and credentials to 60% by the year 2025, focused on ensuring an accessible, responsive, and accountable higher education system. And by the team at Gelser Investment Management, focused on individuals and families, helping to build, manage, preserve, and transfer wealth for generations, commemorating 45 years in business. Gelser.